Let me start. They're all my good friends, so I haven't a clue of where to start. But I guess what we all four have in common is each of us is experimenting in a different way with communities, and this seems to be also what you're involved in. So I suppose the best thing to do is to talk something about community and cultural transformation, and just I'll try to talk for just a short time and return the favor to Harvey. What I've been doing the last 2 years or so is, since I first visited Palo to come out here in August of 71 to see Koh Santee and go to the Hopi snake dance and look at two different kind of visions of the transformation of human culture, which reminded me a lot of Arthur C. Clarke's novel, The City and the Stars. One, the kind of diaspora of the vision of the affirmation of the city as a vehicle, of cultural human evolution. And then the Hopi vision of more the smaller pueblo and the idea of consciousness itself as its own vehicle of cultural evolution. And so I've been traveling around and looking at various kinds of places around the world, going to Oroville in India and the Findhorn community in Scotland, where they talk to plants and have a kind of spiritual community there. Mainly I'm interested in mysticism and science and the convergence between these seeming opposites. And went to a community in Germany that's a research foundation for Eastern wisdom and Western science, which is concerned with the interface between physics and yoga. So, and the thing that seems to be happening all around the world is that industrial society at its limit of growth is beginning to destructure. Sometimes we sense that it's destroying itself, so we generate large mythologies of cosmic destruction of the limits to growth variety and ecological catastrophe ending human culture by the year 2000. But whether or not it's destroying itself, it definitely seems to be destructuring itself, and that a lot of the things that were necessary before are no longer necessary, and there are new possibilities that you no longer, in a sense, once the cities contained the definition of human culture and you had to go to the city because that's where it was at, you had to go to London or New York or whatever. And now there seems to be an intense kind of energy surrounding the planet itself that's spilling the energy everywhere, and the center is everywhere, and the circumference is nowhere, so that Paulo Soleri in Scottsdale, or Bucky Fuller when he used to be in Carbondale, or all sorts of people spread out in all sorts of out-of-the-way places are more intensely involved, in a sense, with the center of things than those sophisticated New Yorkers or people in Paris who are working on a definition of what culture is by looking pretty much at the past. When sort of prophets begin talking about the future, they're often really just looking at the present and using the future as an imaginative way to describe the implications of the present. And they see more clearly the present in the way that Blake understood what the Industrial Revolution was all about better than the experts did, and you could see it quite early. When other people look at the present, they look at it and begin to describe the past and see in terms of institutions what human culture is all about, that you have to go to universities to be wise, churches to be holy, and you have to go to concerts or museums to find what art is all about. And now it seems to be that that's pretty much ending, and there's an intense kind of energy flowing everywhere, and that it's almost as if what Teilhard de Chardin described as the noosphere is not a metaphor, that there is actually a psychic field of energy enveloping the planet. There's a beautiful description of this in a novel by Doris Lessing called Briefing for a Descent into Hell, which a guy takes a ride in a crystal and sees the earth and knows it for the first time. That this psychic field of energy is an envelopment of consciousness that has contained in it the seeds of what will perhaps later become institutions, although it may be at a we may be in a situation now in human cultural evolution where institutions themselves may no longer be as necessary as they once were, and that we now can afford a kind of anarchism that that was only imagined by science fiction writers before. But this envelopment of energy is so intense that it seems to be that the only way to get at it is, in a sense, or one of the ways, but let's say the only way, just for the sake of rhetoric, so that Harvey and I can have something to argue about. The only way to get at it is, in a sense, to ask yourself, what happens when I subtract the institution from my identity? What happens when I subtract the job from my identity? And facing the absolute burden of your freedom, encountering the consciousness of the self that seems to be withdrawing from civilization and culture, but by a paradoxical turn of the spiral, you find yourselves very much in the center of things, that center that is everywhere and the circumference that is nowhere. And you come out of walking out of institutional, urban, industrial, nation-state culture and finding yourself converging with all sorts of other people walking out, and you find yourselves right smack in the middle of a planetary renaissance, and that there is something is going on of an enormously exciting, energizing, and revisioning of human culture that can't be contained by institutions. That so now it seems that institutions are no longer adequate vehicles of cultural evolution, and that the paradoxical relationship between the human group as an evolution of group consciousness, not the institution, this is more a psychic geometry, like coins tossed by the I Ching, and the individual and his aloneness converge, and there becomes a very crossing, to use a Christian metaphor, of the unique individual in all his supremely individuated and solitary qualities, and the universal, as if you took a snowflake and you saw that it was a unique crystal, but that all snow is white, and there was this convergence of unique and universal. And that through the energizing of the unique is the discovery of the universal. This is, in a sense, what the rock groups were messing around with and what the Beatles were messing around with. The more you became an individual, the more you had to contribute to that super organic unity that was the Beatles as a kind of mystical quaternity. The old political definition is that the individual doesn't matter. You're a unit, and in order to matter, you have to be counted, because that's what really counts, and you've got to be gathered together in the form of votes and dollars and large mass demonstrations. And if you got enough units in the mass, somehow you had power, and you could take over the White House or elevate the Pentagon, and you could begin to really heap things up and matter. So the definition of the self was a material one, and it was very much industrial, so that in a sense, the New Left movement, which we all recognize has failed and is over, just as the 60s are over and the counterculture thing is ended and the rock thing is ended, and something else is beginning again, like waves coming in on the shore. Something else is hitting us now. The 70s are very different from the 60s. So that the paradox was that the political people in power were trying to consolidate everybody, and the political revolutionaries outside of power were trying to consolidate everybody. And that we were all locked into a political and industrial model of what human culture was all about, so that if we wanted, on the one hand, to revision culture, we still had to pick up the same old tools of the industrial nation state. So that it became very clear that the revolution had to go deeper than that, and had to be a transformation of consciousness. And to do that, one had to think in larger terms than just industrial technology. What happens if you subtract technology from yourself? You end up getting involved in a mysticism. So that mysticism, in a way, whether it was the Chardin variety that Paulo's interested in, or the Sri Aurobindo variety that others are interested in, became a way of putting man on a cosmic scale and putting the machine in its proper place by surrounding the machine with a cultural envelopment. It seems like now what's going on in the culture is a war, a very stylized, subtle war. But that it's a war between, let's just say institutions and human culture at large, that institutions are trying to surround culture and trying to subsume all dimensions of culture into their structures. So that you have, say, at Stanford Research Institute, research going on in terms of psychokinesis, psychic powers, bending of metal bars and rings by Uri Geller, research into human potential, and other research into how are mythic images of man generated and how can these be used by management for more intelligent management of society. So that the education business is a convergence of big government, big think tanks, big foundations, big corporations, creating an absolute enclosing structure that makes management the structure and human culture a content within it. So that this is what America for the most part is all about. But going on around that is an attempt to surround those structures to surround technology and management with a psychic field of consciousness, with an envelopment of culture that is larger than those structures, so that the human renaissance is more important than the technological reforms from within, or various kind of management innovations. And so they're fighting back and forth with one another, and it's a very stylized dance, and so nobody is winning, and it's like the tension of opposites. You saw it very clearly and dramatically expressed as you look at all the moonshots, because the Russians sent up efficient technological instruments of measurement and surrounded the Earth with technology and made man into a content within that structure. So it's very clear that they were affirming the iron lock that industrial materialism had upon their own dialectical materialist tradition. And so human culture was displaced. The Americans, because we tend to be a more mythological, cowboy-oriented people wanting to pace in cowboy boots across the moon, insisted on sending up our astronauts and sending up men to pace upon the moon. And what happened was a kind of an antidromia, a movement of from one thing into its exact opposite, where the astronauts looked down upon the face of the Earth and were transformed. So the astronaut on the way to the moon was like Saul on the way to Damascus, and he was knocked off his piece of technology, knocked off his horse, and a new kind of wonder and a rediscovery of wonder changed his whole sense of human identity. And what came about was a kind of mystical affirmation of consciousness being more primary and more prior to technology itself. So man surrounded his NASA instruments with a cultural affirmation of humanity. In this case, many of these astronauts got involved in a kind of religious awakening. Rusty Schweikert is doing transcendental meditation. Edgar Mitchell quit and established an institute for research into consciousness and psychic phenomena. And others went back to their Baptist heritage and became ministers. So that whichever way one wanted to take it, one saw a strange and unpredictable transformation of consciousness. Just a few years ago, when the movie 2001 came out, we saw how very much there was a situation in which the astronauts were seen as robots and the machines were seen as human. And the whole movie was about the war between the machine and the human as the end of one kind of cultural evolution. And that's what everyone would have predicted. But what developed was something more utterly surprising, this rediscovery of wonder, this transformation of consciousness, and this discovering of the cosmic scale that finally was able to put technology into its place. So what one can draw from that is, in a sense, that the only something that large and that cosmic really can put our technology in place, that if we try to humanize our technology with Marxism, we're restricting ourselves to what was originally a critique of industrial society, and therefore has all the limitations of an industrial analysis built into it. If we try to humanize technology with the New York Review of Books, we're limiting ourselves to a very New York City-oriented, civilized, sophisticated model, which doesn't have the chthonic or celestial power to deal with technology on this planetary scale. So that it seems that man, only at the extreme end of his religious imagination, is able to find sufficient space to deal with technology. If you try to deal with technology from inside institutions, you become reduced to a functionary of the tool. If you walk outside it and grab it from the outside, which is the only way you can handle a tool, then you turn it into a tool and you are a man using a tool. And when, in terms of evolution, you no longer want to use a tool, you drop it and go on to something else, which is the secret of our unique generalized adaptability rather than being specialized for a function. So mysticism becomes very critically involved with what human cultural evolution is all about. In this sense, I think people like Apollo is one example in terms of architecture, but I think another example is Stockhausen, who's a superb mathematician, electronics engineer, and composer, who can use all kinds of technology. He's not afraid of it in the way that, say, we were afraid of technology in the 60s and wanted to return to nature and become primitive in an absolutely rigorous and remorseless kind of way. Stockhausen can use all kinds of fantastic technology, but there's no way that it's using him. He's just able to surround it with culture and turn it into an art form, and he becomes a kind of Wagner of the electronic era. So it's very much a battle going on between institutions and culture and which is to survive, so that all of these places around the world, whether it's the planetary city of Oroville or the planetary town of Fintorn in Scotland or a kind of center for planetary renewal and architecture here at Arcosanti, become very critical experiments in the ability of human beings to sense the cultural crisis ahead and change the development of the cultural vehicle by which they move through space-time. It's almost as if we have to get some sense of the feedback of disasters ahead of us and streamline and get rid of the drag and get rid of the things that are slowing down and heading us for disaster. And some of the drag we carry with us are our institutions and our management structures and the whole attempt to surround consciousness and contain it. So this becomes the critical issue, and this is why I think all of us in different ways are experimenting with different forms of human institutions. But that's enough.
I'm trying to think, what is there left to say? My name's Harvey Cox, and I think of myself as a theologian. I used to be embarrassed about that because people would say, you mean you're really a student of comparative religion or a sociologist of religion? I would say, yes, something like that. But now I'm not very apologetic about that, because for me, a theologian is one who is not just studying about something, but is asking his own or her own question and is involved in a quest which is personal and existential and not simply academic or scholarly. So that St. Augustine starts out his great treatise, The Confessions, with a prayer. Thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. And whatever that thee means, I think that that's really the best theology. The best theology is when you start by saying, this isn't just something I'm learning about. This is a personal quest, which may also turn out to be a civilizational quest. I think the greatest surprise that occurs is when one asks one's own question passionately and seriously and tries to live as though that question were really an important, overwhelming question, one does discover that there are a lot of other people who are asking that same question. So I've been trying, and I think this is something that Bill and I have in common, I've been trying to see at what points the things that I'm thinking about and writing about and researching seem to be contradicting the way I've been living. And I'm finding a few of them, and at some points I have the courage to make the necessary changes, at other points I don't. So I still teach at Harvard University. This year I don't. I'm on my own for 1 year. But I'm on the faculty at Harvard, and Harvard has been pretty good to me so far. I want to talk about two things that I've been doing that have to do a little bit with planetary consciousness and mysticism and community. I'm very impressed by the fact that the points at which community seems to be emerging in the world is on the planetary basis, that is on the global basis, and in very highly particularized local situations. What seems to be dropping out is and I hope it will drop out faster and faster, is any idea of the sovereign national state as a viable form of community for the future of the human race. I think we've already learned that this is an absurd way of organizing the globe. And I find that there is, in many of the so-called advanced countries, there is less and less investment of loyalty, energy, and imagination in the sovereign national state. People are really a little embarrassed about that now, since we can fly places very quickly, and we meet people from other countries. The whole idea of the national state seems to be fading away, although it seems to be very important for some people in the third world countries. Now the question is, what replaces that? If people need, as I believe they do, a sense of community, belonging to something, rather than just being isolates, what community replaces that national community, which since the French Revolution, and perhaps in the period before that, but certainly since the French Revolution, has been the way in which Western people have largely identified themselves as Frenchmen or Germans or citizens of the United States of America or Canadians or something like that. A lot of people were willing to fight and bleed and die for that flag, for that concept, for that abstraction. Now that's really fading away. And what is taking its place? I think the idea of the planetary species is one community that we now begin to feel ourselves a part of, really for the first time. Yeah, this is really, although this seems rather natural to many of us, this is really not something that our forebears and generations far removed identified with very strongly. And still, we don't quite yet have the symbols and the emblems and the holidays and the metaphors to think of ourselves in this planetary community, but they're beginning to come. I do think the moonshot had something to do with that, seeing the Earth as that fragile little green disc that we all somehow had to share. These sentiments are beginning to grow, and I hope they will grow further. But I think the other thing that's beginning to emerge is a sense of one's participation in a group of people on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis, sharing a turf, sharing a locale, a place that one has responsibility for, that one loves, nourishes, touches, that kind of earthy identification. And I think these are both possible. In fact, I think probably they're complementary. So I've been working on both of these, and in the following way, and this is about 3 minutes on each. As a person whose major interest has been in religion and in the history and development of the great world religions, I think we're at that stage in human consciousness in which we simply have to learn now how to put ourselves into the religious consciousness of other traditions and other cultures by an act of imagination or will or playfulness or theatrical engagement or whatever it is. I don't think it's safe for us to live on the planet much longer thinking of the other religious traditions other than our own as somehow remote or esoteric or in some way funny. So I'm trying to discover ways in my own teaching not just to teach people about Hinduism or pre-literate religion, or the Bantus, or the Confucianists, or whoever, but somehow to find ways to get people to move temporarily inside of these traditions, to see how they feel from the inside, so that the convergence that we're all looking for won't be some kind of artificial synthesis in which we stick together, we agglutinate together segments that look kind of awkward and wrongly placed, but there really will be some kind of planetary consciousness in which we build up a store of experience of the various traditions and where they've come from. We aren't afraid to do that. We aren't afraid of losing our own selves, our own identities, by projecting ourselves into that kind of experience. I think that can be done. And I can say a little more about that if you're interested. The other thing I've been doing, we've been talking a lot about that at breakfast and the rest during part of the day. I'm a member of a community of 12 families. Small, just kind of regular middle-class American families, all living in North Cambridge, which is the section of Cambridge, Massachusetts, near Somerville, who have formed a kind of a living community in which we share a residential ambience. We have bought together an apartment house and a couple other houses into which we are now moving. Most of us are already in it. We've begun a kind of income, a modest income redistribution scheme. We're beginning to buy our groceries together. Some of the families are cooking their meals together. So this may, this may sound at first a little like a commune. We don't like to call it a commune. We like to think of it as a restoration of a sense of community at the very local, day-to-day basis of our lives. These are all people who are involved in other things. We're not all taken up completely by this community. We're working in teaching or in politics or in city planning or in five or six other kinds of things. But we have this common place. That's why we call it Common Place Incorporation. Common Place. We have a common place that we come back to, which has a position on this earth, which has turf under it, which has streets around it and bricks, rooms, and a kind of viability, a place you can touch and smell and fix up and work on, like this place here. Although we had to buy a leftover place and fix it up. Nonetheless, we're all getting that sense of what it means to share a specific location. We feel it's important to do this in part because of the isolation which is dictated for us by the way nuclear family development has pursued its course and the way in which mortgages for 30 or 40 years become the kind of captors of families that find it, feel that that's the way they want to live. So instead of having all those little mortgages that families would have, we now have one great, huge mortgage that we all try to help share paying. But at least, you know, it doesn't feel as bad. Having one huge mortgage that you're sharing with 11 other families doesn't quite get to you the way that the monthly single mortgage payment used to. It's a different feeling. We're sharing child rearing. We're sharing a lot of things, including including to some extent income. Now, this is a group of people that have a kind of a religious. We have a religious heritage in common. Most of us feel to some extent alienated from it. It's really just basic Protestant Christian. Almost kind of sectarian Protestantism that we all grew up in which there's an emphasis on sharing, there's an emphasis on experience, there's an emphasis on lack of pretense and on simplicity, living simply, not engaging in conspicuous consumption, and also in involving as many people as possible in the decision-making process. So we try to do everything in this community that we can. Like a Quaker meeting, because we take no votes, and we try to arrive at a consensus, or what we call a consensus meeting. We have not yet ever taken a vote on anything, but we take straw votes occasionally, so that people know where everybody else is. We try not to take votes. Now, what I'm trying to do is to put together in my own life my feeling that I have to develop a kind of pluralistic consciousness. I have to be a voyager and an explorer in forms of religious consciousness very different from my own, even to the point where it threatens my soul. And at the same time, finding that my own religious tradition, if taken seriously and if lived out, if not just given lip service, but actually organized into a communal expression, that is also a terribly important part of my life. And I don't quite know how both of those go together yet. I don't really quite know how to be a planetary man and also a simple sharer in a community in North Cambridge. See, I'm sitting out here today because I came on a jet plane last night. I'm not there. And maybe next week I'll be somewhere else. A lot of people can put that together more easily than I can. For me, that's still a tension. It's still I still feel the pain of that kind of division. But I'm working on it and hoping that I'll eventually get there. I think I'll stop at that point and let Mel pick up, and then we'll go on from there.
I'm a shrink. So I think I'd have to talk about these issues from a different point of view. Maybe stopping at pain is a good place to start from. I've spent a good many years now trying to look at group and family dynamics and community as it relates to the individual, to the individual's mental health. Perhaps one way of looking at the 60s was that we all felt, or many of us felt, that all we needed to do was to change the other guy. So. Make life richer and better for all of us. Many of us went about very vigorously trying to change the other guy. And that didn't work for any number of reasons. But during that time, I spent a good deal of time in Mississippi and working with people who were trying to change the other guy and the casualties of that. And there were a great many based on the perhaps some of the lack of appreciation what is involved when you engage in that kind of stressful activity, and when you put yourself in a new environment that is so at variance with the one you come from, perhaps much more than any of us had anticipated or understood at the time. After that, I was involved for a long period of time working in a ghetto with a lot of groups based on the idea that we were going to see what could be done by way of helping community develop its own competence and a relationship of that community development, level of community development, to the health and competence of individuals who are living in that community. I guess many of us were working in those kinds of programs, and most of those programs have been very, unfortunately, not very successful. After that, I guess, there was a big movement to begin to look at oneself and try to change oneself. And that's not a new thing. People have been always working and trying to change themselves in a variety of ways, through drugs, sex, politics, meditation, various forms of activity, and through developing new communities, large communities or small communities, with some notion that if one could develop the right kind of community, whatever that might mean, that that will change me and us. It raises lots of issues. I mean, one, from a sociological point of view, is certainly the meaningfulness of a model, of a demonstration model, the power of a demonstration model, social change. I think perhaps Bill can talk more on that point than I, but I don't think models have been very successful in the sense that we're talking about. The other is that many people engaging in these kinds of efforts through new communities are perhaps embarking on activities that are in some ways more dangerous than they perceive them to be. And I don't want to sound proper of doom, because I feel very, very much in favor of what's going on. I am involved myself in a variety of ways, and we can talk about that. But last week I saw a 42-year-old man on emergency consultation who was having a breakdown, who was in a group marriage. And this is a man who is a very sophisticated man, and had done a lot of thinking about that kind of relationship, but somehow had not been able to anticipate the kinds of stresses that would develop in the course of it, particularly one issue that his wife, who was significantly younger, fell in love with one of the other men in that group, and it reached a point where he found it intolerable. The week before that, I saw a 20-year-old girl who had been in a commune that broke up, and she was in a terrible state because she had been so separated from any other community. That commune was her only community, and she was left without any community to identify with. So what we've been trying to do, what I've been involved, is sort of trying to look at a number of experimental and various family forms and communal arrangements, both from the point of view of trying to understand them better, particularly from the point of view of the impact on the individuals in those communities, and trying to develop some kind of support system for them, some kind of mental health service system outside of the existing system, which would help people think through or deal with some of the crises that are bound to occur in such kinds of situations. For example, we're just now beginning a study of child-rearing and group marriages to get some sense of what the impact is on the identity of children growing up in that kind of environment. So that I think for me, the issue here, move back to Akrasanti, is that one of the major reasons I became involved some years back had to do with the interest in a, if you'll excuse the term, a living laboratory. We're in the process here of trying to develop community and learn about community through building. Very unique situation. And I think that the kinds of things that we're talking about today, in terms of what kinds of social forms
So why don't we involve you now? Why don't we start talking among ourselves?
We are definitely trying to find some way of surviving in the city. That's a conscious choice we have made not to leave the city. And we realize that we think we can't do it as isolated nuclear families. We've seen too many tensions, too many disasters, too many casualties. And we talk about the casualties of new forms of community. Think of the casualties of old forms of community, including nuclear families, isolated nuclear. I'm not talking about group. We don't have a group marriage. What we have is families who are living together some people call it a cluster. We like to think of it as a cluster. We spatially close together, interacting much more than families normally do, sharing in the financial obligations of each other and in the property ownership. I think the property ownership thing is very important. I think there is a certain truth to where your money is, there is your heart also. And we all are trying to get away from, we're trying to rediscover or refabricate something that might have been there in the old extended family. And we're finding it, at least I am finding it, very, very rewarding and positive, with very little of kind of disastrous consequences that some people predicted. Well, first of all, we had to organize, we had to get the group together. We had to arrive at some kind of consensus of who we wanted to be. We had to draw up some basic kind of agreement. We had to decide on the place that we were going to buy. We had to cough up the money. And we had to decide on what basis we were going to cough up the money, whether it was going to be equal or more from those who could afford more. Then we just spend a lot of time together talking about the various problems we're facing or we might face. Child rearing, sex, we spend a lot of time, spent and do spend a lot of time talking about that because it's constantly there as an issue. Money. And this is a group of people who share a kind of commitment to what we understand Christianity to be. Not as a thought system, but as a way of life in which sharing and simplicity and honesty and candor with each other, loving each other, and resisting peace. Everybody in the movement, in this group, is very active in one way or another in the peace movement, has been in the peace movement. So these, yeah, it's a very simple kind of thing. It's not very elaborate. So we sing together, we dance together, we drink a lot of wine together. Not just communion wine, I mean large quantities of wine. We share child rearing, we share in the work on the house, fixing it, making it over.
It's not one house, one large house, yeah.
It's one large house and one nearby, one apartment house and one nearby large house. And we hope to get another house that will be sort of linked, three of them.
Because the group is going to get bigger?
Some of the people in the group don't yet live in the property that we own because it's not adequate for the space. Is not.
Given where the members of that group are, does the scale of that operation seem to be critical?
Yeah. We don't think that we should have anybody else in this particular group. We're willing to help people. We are trying now to help other groups that are trying to do the same thing. But we think that 12 families, which amounts, I think now, to 9 people, including all the children, is optimum and maybe even a little too big. We think maybe if we'd had 8 or 10.
These relate as individual families to each other, but a separate personality from another unit, therefore self.
selfish?
Excuse me?
These relate to other units. Therefore, your unit can't grow any larger. You don't foresee it growing any larger. Other units of its same sort, how would this unit relate to some unit?
Yeah, well, we're starting to work that out. One of the ways would be politically. That is, we can begin to do things in a city of our size politically if we know each other. The other is economically, buying things together. And also, we can enlarge the grocery co-op and get things even cheaper. And the other thing is spiritually. See, Cambridge has a lot of religiously based communes and collectives now. There's a Tibetan Buddhist place, there's a Sufi commune, there's a Jewish community called Chabarat Shalom, and there are five or six others. And we're now beginning to be in touch with each other. And I find that kind of interreligious communication has a reality that that just studying comparative religion doesn't have.
Yeah, I understand, but what I was trying to ask is that you have defined the size of your community and decided on its personality by deciding that it will only grow so large. How does the personality of your community deal with personalities of other communities? Is there a selfishness? I mean, is there a desire to find the best bargains for your community, though you may also be including other of those same size communities in your dealings?
I think a certain amount of energy focuses on your own community. Yeah, I think it would be dishonest to.
How does that differ from the very small?
Well, as long as it's a very, very small nationalism, I don't. I'm not against it. I think it's okay as long as you maintain that kind of openness to other communities and that kind of pluralism. And I don't think you have to include them in your community in order to love them or be a part of them. I think that's been the big mistake of nationalism. We had to really, it's the hidden imperial side of
nationalism. Well, you just make more numbers in a single personality, that's all. Is that not true?
More numbers?
The single personality of a small unit like that would be as potent or have the same potential that the single personality of one being might have in dealing with other people.
I don't think we've arrived at that degree of collective consciousness yet. I'm not even sure we want to. There is a funny kind of beginning evidence of collective consciousness that I wouldn't have expected in this group. Like, when you live together and talk that much about things, you begin to... There's some kind of communication going on that I don't understand, where people really just do kind of know what's happening. But it isn't, I don't think of it as a kind of group personality yet. I don't think I would like that too much.
I would say that that's inevitable. And if you're going to live together for any period of time, you're going to develop that group personality, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And at that point, you begin to either subgroup or develop factions or lose some people and add some. I think that's just part of inheriting group life.
Yeah, some of the communities develop a group ego that begins to have a lot of strength in some of these planetary groups, because what a nation state has going for it is, in a sense, powerful symbols of you know, blood and soil and flag over centuries that really bind consciousness in various forms of tradition. And when you step out of that and you're no longer having the bonding of consciousness through tradition and an image of the past, but you're basing it on an image of the future, then you you have to work in much smaller kinds of groups, because you can't deal with collective abstractions like the nation state. So you do get a kind of sense of the growth of a group ego. It's not necessarily bad, because if you think of the planetary transformation of mankind as a kind of kinetic state of consciousness, that it's like boiling water, where these tiny little bubbles that create a gas and then dissipate in the mass, they have no force, and then a few of them gather together and create larger bubbles moving up, and then boom, at a critical state, the whole thing takes off and evaporates and goes in. So that a lot of this is happening to mankind as a whole, and there's a kind of inertial, you know, solid mass of where we've been.
and now there is this kind of movement, and you sense in many of these places the creation not of a collective unconscious in the way of, say, Durkheim would talk about, or Jung, but a collective consciousness in which the individual mind is figure against the ground of being. Now, the usual way that this has been discussed is in terms of science fiction, or Théo de Chardin, or Paulo talks about it in terms of the organism of a thousand minds in The City and the Image of Man. The first attempt to create this in the 20th century was the elevation of the collective unconsciousness into culture, which you saw in things like the Irish Revolution, National Socialism, where archetypes flood the streets and people go out to die in the streets as if they were living in a drama, a novel, and everything becomes possessed with kind of a demonic energy. And the second way was the collectivization of consciousness in the state, of the Stalinesque and Maoist variety, which in terms of numbers is the simplest way to do it. The difficulty with that is you have to step down the energies of the ego, and you do it through ego reduction rather than ego transfiguration. And I think in this planetary transformation, which is more like Romanticism or the Renaissance, there is an attempt to find the universal by going through the eye of the needle, by going through the unique consciousness of the self. And as this goes on, it has to go through in small groups. You can't. A lot of people are great at loving mankind, but they have trouble with men. You know, just as a lot of the Irish revolutionaries wanted to die for Ireland, but damn few of the IRA could live in Ireland. You know, they're only good at gunning people down in the streets. So that the trouble with the whole liberal movement was that we had this kind of holistic frame of mind where everything had to solve everything, you know, all at once. You know, it had to be take care of housing and development in one fell swoop. So that I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with loving, you know, men and women as a start, rather than trying to get involved in universal abstractions. There probably will be the growth of intense egos in these communities where if people are into a behavioral psychology number as the group bonding, then they'll feel strong, effective attachment to that. If they're into, you know, talking with Davis and leprechauns in Findhorn, and they begin to have, you know, become famous around the world for growing plants through conversation, then Findhorn begins to take on a very strong group ego, that we are a planetary new age town. Other people are old age cities, you know, or old age nations. And that's part of the puberty of the planet. You've got to go through adolescence, get an identity, before, in terms of Buddhism, then you can lose your identity. If you go into the transformation of consciousness without a strong, healthy ego, you become psychotic.
Well,
so,
is the increase in the temperature of this pot increasing fast enough to keep up with the influx of the added liquid? I mean, there have been these bubblings for a long time.
Yeah, you have to look at time
and
not scale.
Is it just shifting, or is there actually a gaining of ground? Is the basic temperature of the body becoming higher?
I think it's going higher, and there's a transformation of state, and that I think, and here I'd go along with Marx when he looked at the levelers and said that these, you know, 17th century early movements, other things, pietism, things that Harvey studied, were early prefigurings. But it's a very lonely thing to be, you know, a bubble 3 centuries in advance of your time. But now we see there are more scientists in existence now in the 20th century than have existed in the whole history of mankind. We can say the same thing about mystics. There is a heating up of consciousness. There is more in science and art and energy and mysticism than before in the solitary St. John of the Cross or Teresa of Avila. This is a very different kind of situation. So I think we see an incredible feedback of consciousness back on nature, which generally, because of the way the human mind works, we see it negatively. We're destroying the planet. We see the feedback of consciousness in the air, and it's called filth. But I think inversely, by a related symmetry, there's a feedback of consciousness on nature, which is what culture is, that is positive and dynamic, and that before we can see it on the body of the planet, we have to discover it in the body of ourselves and rediscover the mind-body interface in the way that Swami Rama did in the Meninger Institute when he stopped his heart for 17 seconds under impeccable scientific observation. So what's contained in this planetary transformation is a redefinition of nature, a redefinition of mind, and the redefinition of consciousness and the whole mind-nature-consciousness continuum. And that's something that's a bit different than just Romanticism and the Industrial Revolution or things of that sort. So I think something is happening, you know, of a very intense period. It may fail, though. There's no guarantee that just because it's happening, we're going to make it.
When you mention these terms in this discussion, you're speaking from a particular framework of people who are knowledgeable of these terms. But it seems to me I came from about 10 years of being in New York City and watching people on the subways and buses, and I saw them go through the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the first evaluation, the second evaluation. They all look the same through all of that. So It seems to me that you talk of consciousness and awareness and a planetary upheaval of consciousness, which I agree. I think that we are going in that direction. The question would be, what proportion of the total planetary population is involved in this?
The numbers don't matter because the individual consciousnesses are like enzymes, and enzymes can have an enormous catalytic change over an organism, you know, where the organism is a hundredfold larger than the size of the enzyme.
But even enzymes have, like, percentage.
Can I ask you
sure.
An alternative question? What would be your comment on the current upheaval in Washington with Nixon in relation to...
Well, there are like three questions going on, so let me take them all at once. One, numbers don't matter. That's a numbers game. We're units into a mass. An illustration I've used before in terms of Blake and the Industrial Revolution is if you were a Martian and you hit London and you came in around 1790 and you said, "Hey, man, there's an Industrial Revolution going on here," and the people would think, "It's serious, man. You know, it's agricultural civilization all over," and you'd point to one brick kiln and one factory. And you say, "So what's one factory? Get serious. You know, this, look what's going on." But Blake would not. He would take that one brick kiln and one factory and he would extrapolate and he would see the industrial transformation. So that events, macro scale events, like cultural transformations, are invisible for the most part. Because most of the people are looking at the present and seeing the past, but the other guy is looking at the present and seeing by extrapolation what it means, understands the present, and in order to understand the present, he describes an image of the future. But those images of the future are right here and now. So I don't think numbers matter. 600 freaks ran out and took over a few buildings and created the Irish Free State. They were, you know, they were all crazies. So that the numbers aren't very important in human transformation. So the other thing is about the people on the subway. If you were looking at, to use Dan Juan's phrases, if you were looking at them, you saw no change. If you were seeing them and you saw their auras, you might be surprised at the difference in 10 years. Now, the, what's...
You gotta go back.
What was the third question? Nixon and Watergate. I think the very energy of the cultural transformation is hitting the crystal lattice of American government and knocking out a lot of the impediments and the noise and creating a lot of trouble with the invisible CIA government we've had. So that our whole consciousness of the political process, our noble leader who is virtuous and true and lives in a white, pure house, are all coming apart, and that there's a new possibility for regaining the electoral process, regaining new power for Congress, which is another form of localization. If you had cable television, you can re-achieve the New England town meeting on an electronic level, get rid of the great big bureaucracies of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and change the particular effective relationship of the individual citizen and the nation state. And I think that's a new, unique, universal relationship that is very positive. And so that if this process can go on and Nixon can be forced to resign, which I think is even better than trying to impeach him, then we stand a chance of really having something to celebrate in 1976. If Americans still get lost in this category mistake that president means good, bad president is a contradiction in terms like stop, go, we can't do anything about it, we have to let them stay in, then that's a disaster, and we end up with directorships and dictatorships, and we're, you know, like the Greek colonels. So I think this process is very positive. It's a catharsis. It's getting rid of a lot of shit. Nation states will go away, they'll just be surrounded by larger structures. It's quite possible that a world state would be the most incredibly authoritarian, tyrannical instrument we could come up with. It could be a convergence of multinational corporations and sort of behavioral science that would have effective means of control and try to buy off the individual by giving him lots of apparent civil liberties in the form of a sexual liberation. You know, I'm thinking of the sense that that a lot of things in sexual liberation look to be liberating, can in some sense be binding. In the way that Marcuse talks about it, the Brothers Goncourt said in the 19th century about the role of pornography in the state that one tames the people the way one tames lions, by masturbation. So I think you could get a kind of big New York Tokyoization of the planet run by these large multinational corporations and achieve world government, but it would be a disaster. So it's a question of surrounding the nation states and turning them into contents in a larger structure. I don't think there's anything large enough except the cosmic consciousness of a planetary mysticism that can handle that. I think anything else is piecemeal technology, management, and people are going to be managed in it. So it's, I think some of the dangers that come from abstract forms of redesigning human culture and saying, all right, we're going to get rid of the family, we're going to get rid of the nations, we're going to get rid of this, we're going to get rid of that, and we'll all be free, is that they're dealing in terms of a fantasy landscape of abstractions that have no roots in instincts or the heart or human emotion, so that some of these abstract communities that are secular and don't have the universal chthonic and celestial force of religion or mysticism are doomed to failure and last only, you know, for 6 weeks until they blow up. So I think it's going to take something with much more energy and mythological power, archetypal power, to really sense what the implications of this cultural transformation are all about. But I don't expect nation states will disappear. They will, they'll just be surrounded by something else. It's spiritual, but I think in the period of civilization, which is pretty much from 3000 to say 2000, the spiritual imagination of man was contained in universal religions, churches and things. In some ways, if we take the century of religious genius, the 6th century BC of Zoroaster and Confucius and Lao Tse and Pythagoras, we can see what Mumford and Yaspers talk about, that the internal contradictions of civilization became so extreme that they had to be mediated by some other force, of course, with universal religions like Buddhism. They were, in a sense, the rehearsal for this planetary integration going on. This is why all those religions are coming up, you know, fast and furious. But I think now, given the intense energy that's in culture and not in the containers, you can have the spiritual imagination of mankind express itself in forms other than just another planetary religion led by another guru or another thought guru. And I think in the thing that's coming now, I think it's going to be more anarchist. And man will need religions or churches as much as a fish needs rubber swim fins. But I'm sure Harvey and I would probably disagree on this.
What I'm getting
Well, I think it's more important in the sense to go through some of these techniques which lead you to certain levels of consciousness where the words don't become so important, whether one tries to call it the unnamed or the ineffable or the ineluctable modality of the visible or the Satori or Samadhi or enlightenment or the resurrection of the body or the second coming, are all like hubs for the single wheel. And the important point is to get to the center for the experience and not to argue theologically about the thing in process. It's I think this is the difference between the mystic and the theologian. Is no, I won't say that. That's unkind.
Go ahead and say it. How do we know if it's unkind?
Why I think mysticism is more important in a sense is it's the affirmation of the experiential quality of it. In theology, it's possible not to know what you're talking about. And in mysticism, one moves into the silence. And so I think when one tries to make the silent spoken, I'd paraphrase Wittgenstein to say, about that which we cannot speak, we should be silent, but we can sing it. So that about that which we cannot sing, we should sing. About that which we cannot speak, we should sing. And there we get things like the B minor Mass or the Sistine Chapel or stuff like this. So that I think one can see images of planetary mythology being created by artists like Stockhausen or Doris Lessing or people of this sort, or even in the rock culture of the 60s. But I don't think necessarily it's going to have a coherent, articulated theology. I would hope not.
Very real threat to me, and I was wondering how, you know, whether you really think that's a possibility or whether there's any way of avoiding it. I think it's best to avoid it through changing the nature of culture. If they're operating on an industrial model of reality and are trying to distribute that industrial model of reality through the universities, which have a particular definition that of human nature is rational, that what is important is your IQ, that if you're a gifted student or a child in the state of California, that is an asset of the state, and therefore you're entitled to state funds, so you can go to state universities to learn how to be a state-educated person because you're a commodity that is valuable for the increase of the gross national product, then the important thing to do is not to get involved in that structure, but to redefine the nature of an educated man, to place it on something other than rationality and the IQ, and to try and surround their management techniques with a kind of psychic field that has a totally different image of what nature, mind, and reality, and culture, and consciousness are all about. In this sense, you don't use their structures at all, and this gives you other flexibility. But there are lots. Sometimes, also, the institutions don't understand themselves. A lot of multinational corporations do not understand what multinational business is all about. They're still thinking in terms of profits, and they haven't developed in economics. What are you going to do if because of multinational American-based enterprise, you own 50% of Europe? That puts a drain on the dollar. The drain on the dollar hurts the economy in America, and you find yourself in a double bind where you can't do a planet's business on a nation's currency, and so nobody really has got anything in profit. The contradiction raises up to the point of collapse, and the multinational corporation people end up doing all the wrong things because they simply do not understand what they are doing. Yeah, that's what I think so. Yeah. So there are no economics to explain what's going on now. Depression, inflation, all at the same time. Well, I think the noosphere is...